You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
And we're back with an all-new Keep It Home Edition, minus Aida.
What the hell happened, Aida?
She got hit by a bus.
My favorite way for an Aaron Spelling-like show to progress, not to foreshadow who our guest is.
Yeah, no, she is a bit under the weather, so she will not be joining us this week. But she will be joining us later in the show for a pre-recorded interview with Issa Rae.
But that's not the guest who I was talking about, because we have a very strange Keep It today with two guests. We are also interviewing Kristen Davis, she of a show called Sex in the City that I've only seen probably 11 or 12 times. I don't remember it well. But yes, now
and
she
Melrose
is...
Melrose Place, yeah, of course.
And Melrose Place, which was the Aaron Spelling reference I mentioned earlier. And now the host of a reality show that requires journalistic integrity on our parts, because I have some questions about this show, called Labor of Love. That's all I'll say about it so far.
Truly the early Fox jumped out with not just her Melrose Place, but also this reality show.
Oh, I was thinking about Gia Tolentino, who we had on our show recently, and she was once upon a time on a reality show. Just that whole era of like experimental new reality shows that are crazy and mind-boggling, and then VH1 took those over for a long time. Anyway, what a wonderful part of our history.
Well, excited to talk about all of that with Kristen today, and also we're going to talk about the culture we consumed this week, which was mostly a lot of drama.
Oh, yes.
A lot of music drama. Anyway, we'll be right back. Exciting news! Ahead of this year's elections, the team at Crooked has been hard at work trying to find the best ways for all of you to impact its results aside from casting your own ballot. Now they have an answer. Vote Save America's brand new Adopt a State program.
The Adopt a State program lets you directly support the work of organizers, volunteers, and candidates in the six key battleground states that will be most important to winning a progressive majority in 2020. And those are, of course, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, and North Carolina.
When you sign up to Adopt a State at votesaveamerica.com/adopt, you'll get specific calls to action, things you can do yourself from home right now. That will make a huge impact on the races in these states. What state are you going to adopt?
Oh, gosh. Well, due to the Madonna credibility, I think I will have to pick Michigan. Mm. She does make fun of them an awful lot, and I feel bad for them. They just have a bunch of peninsulas. They're fine people.
I will, of course, be picking my home state of Wisconsin.
Will they take you? They'll take you back? Yeah. Okay, great.
I'm going to start doing Keep It Wisconsin edition. Just me in a field with a cow talking about the election.
Lots of lakes, the occasional tall tree.
Anyway, you can adopt a state now at votesaveamerica.com/adopt. I'm still me, and Khloe Kardashian is still her, allegedly. So what culture have we been consuming this week? Lewis?
Well, first of all, I just want to reference that picture quickly. That picture, what you're talking about, there's some new photo of Khloe Kardashian out that where she doesn't look as Khloe Kardashian as we usually think of her. I really thought that was a picture in 1998 of Denise Richards. Did you not think, oh, Starship Troopers?
Yeah, a lot of people thought it was Denise, and it just quickly became a meme over the weekend. I mean, we rarely talk about the Kardashians when they're not involved in social justice issues, apparently. But I think everyone was truly shocked by this photo. There was a lot of lighting going on, too. It's just she looked very Caucasian. in the way that Kardashians usually do not want to be.
Unfortunately, the best and worst of Twitter to me is when everyone gathers around a photo, because you can tweet the photo and then put your little comment right underneath it. It's like a compact social media experience, mm-hmm. you know. But in this case, it also means people are, whatever, overly critical of usually a woman's looks. Mm-hmm. If we could get into, like, crazier photos, you know, I don't know what I would prefer to see in that space, but just know this is where Twitter is its most toxic and fun. So, I mean, I'm part of the problem, is all I'm saying.
Speaking of some toxicity on social media, this literally happened last week after we recorded, but Miss Lana Del Rey took to Instagram to voice her frustrations about her place in the music industry, specifically her refusal to ooze overt sexuality and her belief that, you know, she is penalized for glamorizing abuse. This happened in the late hours of the evening. I was remember being in bed, unable to fall asleep, and all of a sudden this dropped, and I was like, girl, why are you still awake?
Right.
Posting your 95 theses on Instagram.
Also, there's a quality about this thing that she wrote where it reminds me of my old adage, get out of your mentions, because half of what she's saying, I truly don't know what she is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I can hear that she's talking about being compared to other artists and the content of what she's talking about. But it sounds like she's coming from a place of feeling underappreciated. And then I think, weren't you nominated for Album of the Year at the Grammys last year? Like, I'm just not on the same page at all.
This is a classic case of truly being bothered by things from your past. And like I said, being in your mentions, reading the comments, reading what people write about you online, right? Because I can see her being pressed about criticisms that maybe came from her Born to Die era. When she first came out, she was routinely lambasted by the media. She was made fun of. Her SNL appearance, for instance, became a meme. And that is a part of Lana's past, but it really isn't anything that people are currently talking about. Not only was she nominated for Album of the Year at the Grammys, she had a critically lauded album with Norman fucking Rockwell. Like, it was on everyone's end of year list. And it reminds me of when she got into that fight with Ann Powers, who wrote a review of Norman fucking Rockwell, where she compared Lana to Joni Mitchell,
right,
in the songwriting capabilities that she has. But for some reason, Lana took issue with a critique and just started a whole fight. Like, and of course, the Lana Del Rey fans were jumping on Twitter, dragging Ann Powers, going, who the fuck is this, etc., as stan culture happens to do. It reminds me of this moment because I don't know what she's mad about. I don't know why she chose this particular time to be mad, because no one was talking about Lana Del Rey at this moment as well. Like, she wasn't in the cultural conversation this week, at least.
When this happened, the first leg of the Lana Del Rey social media experiment she embarked upon, I thought, this is a classic keep it situation where it drops on like Tuesday night after we've recorded. We don't get to talk about it. We've missed this moment. And then I mentioned that to Ira at the time, and he said, oh, I have the feeling it's going to go on all week. And then it did. She added a video component. She keeps adding dimensions to this. I'm afraid she's going to apologize to me in my house.
So the first wave of response to this, since I was still awake then because of the quarantine insomnia that I have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sleeping is an exciting new adventure we all get to do now.
Yeah, especially because it's always that small window of between 2 and 4 a.m. where I try to decide if I'm going to take a Xanax to knock myself out or if the episodes of Cheers that I'm watching can put me to sleep.
Oh, what era?
I'm in the middle of season 2.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's about to get juicy. That's exciting.
Yeah. The first people I saw tweeting about it were Black people that I follow in the UK. Like, Black UK Twitter was tweeting about it and making jokes. And I was like, if they're already awake, why is she still awake tweeting this? And then the Lana Del Rey stans tried to get ahead of it, saying, you know, she has a point. You know, she's talking about how the industry treats her and, like, doesn't let her be a feminist. But people were quick to point out that her mention of the specific artists that she did, she mentioned Doja Cat, Cardi B, Kalani, Nicki Minaj, Beyonce, and Ariana and Camila, was really singling out Black women, because she made a point of mentioning that they had gotten number ones recently, specifically, you know, Nicki and Doja went to number one with the Say So remix, like, and Beyonce and Megan Thee Stallion were number two with the Savage remix, you know, made a comment about how these women are able to talk about cheating and, you know, like basically being hoes and, you know, all that sort, and they're not criticized, but she's criticized for glamorizing violence, which was an insane reading of any type of response that these women have ever gotten. Beyonce can't drop an album without being accused of setting women back.
Well, also, it's like, say who's doing the criticizing, to just straw man it up and be like, someone somewhere criticizes me about this and doesn't criticize that. It's like, that's not an actual argument. Like, I can't get on the same page with you if you're not going to be specific about where it's coming from. Is it men? You know, is it pop fans? You know, like, those are different people who deserved criticisms for different reasons. And to just say they all get this type of praise and I don't, one, doesn't make sense to me, and two, feels, I don't mean to diminish everything she said, but it feels like a pity party. That's it.
Yeah, it felt like a pity party, and it had, unfortunately, tinges of racism in it, because she's pointing out mostly women of color. I don't know what Kalani was doing in this, because I
she
love
hear
Kalani,
us talking?
But she but she does not have a number one.
No.
And...
did she hear us talking about her and Charlie Puth that other week? Maybe we set this into motion. I have no idea.
It was another moment where it was like, I don't know where this is coming from, and I also don't know what you're talking about in the context of each sentence.
Yes.
Because Kalani didn't belong in this, and fans were quick to point that out on Twitter, too. Like, that was when she first lost me. And then when she posted her initial response to it, that was when I was like, okay, bitch, I've had it. When she talked about how she was called a Karen and how she was annoyed at the internet making it a women of color issue, I was like, read the room.
I have a comment on Karens that will come at the end of the podcast, but I just want to say also, in the first part of what she said, which we already discussed, she talks about how other women write songs about cheating. What kind of Tipper Gore complaint is that? Who the fuck cares if people write songs about cheating? It's like, also, stop asking for people to appreciate your feminist point of view when you are literally discrediting other people for what they are writing based on the subject matter. Like, that's also anti-feminist.
There's also a weird tangent where she implies that she paved the way for other women like her to sing about the subjects that she sings about, as if Fiona did not fetch some bolt cutters literally a month ago.
And as if music didn't start before the year 2010 or wherever she jumped on the scene.
Like, plenty of women inspired her. Plenty of women were doing what she was doing, and a lot better.
I think Lana Del Rey is just obsessed in a way with not being compared to other people. To me, the tone every time she's come on the internet is that she's coming from an original and authentic place, and that means comparisons to other people are moot. Mm-hmm. But I think she should receive that mainly as a compliment. Having your name put in the same constellation as other, you know, important artists is just how like our brains work. Like, it's it's how we think of, you know, the cultural moment. And she, I think, thinks of it as inherently belittling to her.
Mm-hmm. And it was especially ironic, just because I've always considered the best part of Lana, at least since her inception, was that she had a sense of humor about herself. You know, I assumed that she knew that the shtick she was doing was a commentary, you know, like that she was being meta about the fact that, you know, she sings and acts like Nancy Sinatra brought back from the dead.
Right. I was going to say drowsy Veronica Lake. Yes, right.
Yeah, you know, it's like she was in on the joke most of the time. You know, it's like why she would sing songs like Summertime Sadness and, you know, Young and Beautiful. It was this idea that she knew what her aesthetic was, but she was having fun with it.
And yeah.
This entire situation just made me believe that maybe she takes herself too seriously and doesn't get the joke.
It's not like it's a crime to take yourself seriously, but also stop it every once in a while, you know?
So that was mostly what consumed my week. But also, another artist had to take to Instagram to defend themselves this week. Doja Cat.
Ira, this situation almost needs to be re-explained to me, because as I have absorbed it, I continue to not be able to believe it.
So, Doja Cat, who at this point has been canceled multiple times by the internet. I remember when she first dropped that Moo song that we were really into, and it was revealed that she had said the word faggot so many times in videos before, and she didn't care that she'd said it. And we as gay people had to get over it because we like the bops.
Then somehow we prevailed. Shocking, I know.
Then it was revealed that her entire album was produced by Dr. Luke.
Very 2019 scandal, yes.
Right. Then we were like, you know what? We still listen to Kim Petras. Let's keep it moving.
Press on.
You know, cognitive dissonance works best. And then there came these reports this week. So she apparently used to participate in tiny chat rooms. Rooms where like incels and alt-right men would gather and, I don't know, jack each other off with racist jokes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm assuming that that's what they do. There were a lot of video clips where you could listen to the men talking while she's in the chat room with them, but I really just had no interest in listening to what they were saying.
But why? we all have something we can learn.
So she used to participate in these rooms, and she's there while men are saying racist things, and apparently, you know, sort of like belittling herself for being black and being sexual for them as well. And then there came the fact that she has this song called Didn't Do Nothing, which is a reference to an alt-right racist term that is used for black victims of police brutality. A didn't do nothing, in their words, is, you know, what the surviving members of a victim's family says when that person is killed by the police. You know, like, they didn't do nothing. You know, it's very it's very blackface, very Amos and Andy jiving Jim Crow talk.
Yeah, all the classics.
Anyway, she has a song titled This, and then that's what caused her to get on Instagram claiming, you know, that the song title was her reclaiming this racist term, etc. I don't know. The song is pretty stupid, and nothing about it implies to me a reclamation of the word, but you know what? That's her art.
By the way, I guess we'll get into this when we talk about the Lady Gaga song. I still feel like Say So is the song of the summer. How do you feel about that?
It's a really good song.
I know. I mean, it feels summery to me, you know.
Unfortunately, but the absolute best part of this Doja story is that last night she got on Instagram Live for 30 minutes and gave a sort of apology. It wasn't really an apology. It was really more of an attack. And it made me wonder, where is her handler?
Uh-huh.
Where is her publicist? What are people doing to manage artists in the quarantine? Because this Lana situation, this Doja situation, both of them continuing to unspool and get out of hand. And Doja is on Instagram saying, for people coming into her mentions, attacking her, good for you. She's only clapping for essential workers who have actual jobs to do during this quarantine, and everyone else is irrelevant. The only thing she really seemed sorry for is offending the beehive.
Which, I mean, that tracks, right? Be afraid.
Yeah. She was very, very afraid of the beehive because apparently there's a video of her referring to Beyonce as Beyonce, which some of the beehive says is referring to Beyonce as a monkey.
Oh, God. That better not be what it means.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That seems like a reach to me, but it was enough that she had to issue an apology to the beehive.
Quickly, before we move on, the culture I'm consuming this week. This has to be a movie you care about, and I don't feel like we've discussed it on this podcast ever. I finally watched the original Alien this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
The 1979 Sigourney Weaver epic which I was definitely watching a very remastered version because there's no way it was this amazing looking at the time. There are a fair amount of horror movies like this now, and the first Alien is routinely called a horror movie, but it really is more like a Hitchcock movie to me, and that it's all about dread. Mm-hmm. And I want to say in my pantheon, I talked about the Before movies last week being essential quarantine viewing because they got into the fun of just having a one-on-one conversation about connectivity between two people. This is another essential quarantine viewing to me because it taps into that feeling of quote-unquote uncertain times. Mm-hmm. It taps into something is bigger than all of us, and, you know, we are mere mortals, and let's see what happens. Now, of course, in this case, it ends up being a disaster. The girl from The Birds is no help at all, Veronica Cartwright. but it, to me, it felt I felt a little seen by this movie in a strange way. And also, what you underestimate about this movie looking back is there's no guarantee that Sigourney is going to be the one who survives the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, she's one of several people it could be. And when she, you forget how triumphant it is that she's the one who makes it to the end, not to spoil the whole thing, but I'm sure you realize that Sigourney Weaver moves on to the rest of the franchise afterwards. Are you a huge fan of the original Alien, or do you prefer Aliens?
I love both of them. You know, yeah. I think they're both very different films in the way that Terminator is a very different film from T2.
Yeah, though I think Aliens specifically is like Terminator 2, the same crunchy, noisy type of action movie.
Yeah, Aliens. Yeah, exactly. You know, like both of the sequels go to a different place. And it makes sense that James Cameron is the director of Aliens, right? And Ridley Scott's flavor is in Alien. And I think they're both great movies for different reasons. And I don't really have a favorite off the top of my head, but I absolutely do love Alien. And I love how moody it is, and I love how it feels like a classic horror movie just in a new setting.
Yeah.
Right? Space stations should be creepy.
Total. Yes, exactly. Also, additionally, what I love is the sheer pettiness of everyone involved. Like, there's people complaining about getting paid, or like, do I have to do this if we're heading home already? Mm-hmm. And just nobody on board feels like a hero. They all feel like working stiffs, dealing with this situation. And that's another way it reminds me of the current pandemic is the sheer ambivalence in a certain way to the amount of terror occurring reminds me of, you know, every news story about people assembling in droves at the Ozarks.
It's also just amazing that it birthed Ripley, you know, this female action movie icon that Sigourney plays. And of course, you probably already know that, like, Ripley was written as a man and she played it. And, you know, maybe, unfortunately, that's the way for straight men to write iconic female characters. Because later, when they try to make like an iconic female character, like an Atomic Blonde or something, it just feels like it's trying too hard.
Well, I remember being in college and people talking about Ripley being written as a man and saying like, oh, that's like one way to write an authentic female character is don't think of it as a woman. And then the actor comes in and whatever, adds femaleness. And in retrospect, it just feels like we're saying, you know, well, she's not a woman, she's a person.
Yeah.
You know, it's so crazy that that was taught to me, or I interpreted that story as a way to get interesting female characters, when in a way, I think this worked as an anomaly.
While you were busy watching Alien, in like 2.5 days, I consumed all of this new reality series, Selling Sunset.
Now, my other friends and I that we have mutual friends with, Ira, we have muted several terms on Twitter recently, and Selling Sunset is the new one. People do not shut the fuck up about this. I do not know what is being sold or if it's next to the Whiskey A Go-Go or what. I do not care. Though you're going to tell me now and I'm going to listen.
The second season of the series dropped this past weekend, and I remember the first season debuted around Coachella time last year, and I was there with two of our friends, and I didn't have time to really watch it because I was at Coachella. And then when the second season dropped, so many people who watch the same sort of Bravo shows as me assured me that I would enjoy it. So I started it, and I binged it all, and you know what? It is pretty absurd, but also fantastic.
What is it? What is the show about?
So it's about the Oppenheim Group, which is a real estate broker agency in West Hollywood. And it's about the homes that they sell. But it's run by two brothers, Jason and Brett Oppenheim, and the women who work for them So it's sort of like a $1 million listing plus Real Housewives. You know, it's these women and the drama they get into while they're selling homes mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. And the one of the new girls who starts in season one, who's sort of the entry point into the series, is Chrishell Strauss, who I know because she plays Jordan on Days of Our Lives.
Oh, you've seen that show, I've gathered.
Yeah. She joins the, you know, the lion's den of these women. And, you know, there's this woman, Christine, who is playing reality villain at an 11.
Good.
It gets to be too much by the end of season two, but it's just about their squabbles and, you know, about interacting. And Chrishell is married to Justin Hartley from This Is Us.
Oh.
And also Passions. But, of course, season two finishes and she's still married, but between season two and season three, he divorced her.
Okay.
So the season three preview shows her dealing with the divorce from Justin, who never appeared on the show. So part of it feels like this was like when Kelsey Grammer gave Camille Grammer season one of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. It was like, here, now you have something else. Goodbye.
I have to go be on Boss on Stars or whatever the fuck that is. Well, I'm so grateful now that we have a reality show that rhymes with Chrishell. Chrishell was out there on her own on The Real World Las Vegas. Finally, she has... those used to be my two favorite syllables in reality TV. Chrishell is the perfect reality TV name.
Yes, Chrishell and Chrishell.
Yes.
Well, season two has a new agent named Amanza.
Great. Exactly what I called for.
Chrishell was shook.
And altogether, that sounds like Christella Alonzo. It's very confusing.
Yes. And finally, our gay weekends were consumed with Rain On Me, the new Gaga and Ariana song, which I think is excellent. I like it better than Stupid Love.
I do like it better than Stupid Love. It reminds me of... like at the end of an episode of Queer Eye, when like the makeover is revealed, what kind of song plays, you know?
Well, yes.
Like I'm stepping on out to some house beats. I will say though, because it invokes disco, for Lady Gaga and for Ariana Grande, it's a very disco-y song. And compared to most 2020 music, it is so much more danceable. So I'm already thankful for it in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, for a disco song, it has everything. It has a hook, great vocals. I think one thing it does lack a little bit is a groove. Like, I'm not really sure you can sway to it. You can sort of hop to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, it is ultimately, like, white quality, you know?
This ain't no Donna Summer track.
That's what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
A little something for the Caucasians.
It doesn't have, like, sex in it, really, you know?
Yeah. She wanted to make a little something for the white girls, something in quarantine, something cute for the summer. Listen, I actually would say that I agree with that because the one aspect of its disco-ness that I feel like it's missing is we need a 12-inch single.
Yeah, oh, please.
You know?
We need like, 8.5-minute songs. We need to be making up for Stairway to Heaven all the time. I want them to be long.
The song could have a groove, I feel like, if it were longer, and classic disco songs would be like between 6 and 10 minutes long.
Oh no, Love to Love You Baby is like a one-act play.
Yeah. And so it every time I listen to the song, it feels incredibly short.
Right. And radio-y in that way, you know.
Yeah. Definitely designed for radio, but far too short. I do love this direction of where Chromatica seems to be going. She said she was inspired by house music and disco, and it seems like we're actually getting that from her as opposed to, I don't know, every other pop artist who has promised us a disco album and then never delivered it.
Right.
Carly Rae Jepsen.
I will say about that, though, there's a quality about Madonna where when she does her, like, weird new phase and has a weird new look, at the time when she does it, I usually have this feeling of, is this right? Is this contrived? And then in retrospect, because she was doing actually what she wanted, I usually think it falls in line historically. It ends up looking really flattering and interesting. Whereas with this album, I do worry a little bit if she's just giving us what we want as opposed to what she really would want.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the music is good. So I'm optimistic and I'm excited. That said, you just brought up Carly Rae Jepsen. My favorite song that came out this weekend was Fake Mona Lisa from Dedicated B-Side. Carly Rae Jepsen just released, as she is wont to do, a B-Side album version of a previous album she put out. And for the most part, it's kind of like, it's a cute album. It's familiar Carly Rae Jepsen sounding music. But one song, which is basically unfinished. It's like a 2-minute, 10-second song. Mm-hmm. Fake Mona Lisa. You have got to put this on because that has the squishy, boppity, kind of a danceable groove that I'm talking about that to me makes it even better than Rain On Me.
I like that. I also like This Is What They Say off of that album. There's like a couple really good standout tracks, but ultimately it's probably one of my lesser B-side offerings from her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Emotion B-side being a highlight.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun with Rain On Me, and I really did also appreciate Gaga's Chromatica playlist that she released on Spotify with inspirations that will get you ready to dance and obviously inspired the album. And one of the albums that's on there is the 1999 Cassius album.
Oh, cute. Did she also have Gypsy Woman, She's Homeless by Crystal Waters on that playlist?
I believe she does, yes.
People need to know about the dance music of 93, 94 a little bit more.
Yeah.
That's when you get your Jeanne, which is the definitive barbecue music. So get in on that.
I mean, my favorite Crystal Waters sample is on Diana Ross's If You're Not Gonna Love Me Right.
Yes. Oh, God.
A like 94, 95 album, which is very under-listened to in the Diana Ross catalog.
That's a good recommendation. I love Latter Day Diana Ross. And just like one of my favorite Donna Summer songs is The Latter Day, This Time I Know It's For Real, from the late 80s.
Yeah. Well, anyway, when we're back, we have some serious questions for Kristen Davis. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus, get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's, like, pretty mild outside, and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
Lewis and I are so excited to welcome a guest who needs no introduction, Kristen Davis, who is joining us to talk about many things, but also her new show on Fox, Labor of Love, a reality show where a 41-year-old divorcee has to choose between 15 different men, one of them who will be the candidate to impregnate her. We have a lot of questions.
I'm sure you do.
I'm sitting here with a notepad. My first question is, I guess I'll have Kristen explain it herself, but my first question is, Kristen, what the fuck is going on here?
You know, Lewis, it's tough. It's tough because, like, you know, you have an idea. And in this case, someone came to me with an idea. And we talked about it for, like, 2 years. And it made sense mm-hmm. to us. Do you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? And then sometimes when things hit the air and you see everyone's reaction and you're like, oh, wow, this is so interesting. I mean, that is part of the process, right? I guess. Basically, the gist is that we were sitting around talking about the road to parenthood. Mm-hmm. And this is true for men and women. And, you know, our culture is so focused on success, success, success. And people are waiting later to get married and later to get pregnant. And, you know, what does that mean? And what is it like? And, you know, can you even talk to your friends about it? And we felt like, no, there wasn't really a conversation about this kind of cultural phenomenon right now. Now, obviously, I used to be a part of something that was, in fact, part of the cultural conversation about this, mm-hmm. Sex and the City, obviously, but there hasn't been much to kind of fill the void. So that's how it came about. And then one thing led to another. We met this woman, Christy Katzman, who was already freezing her eggs and kind of on the road to single motherhood. And then we said, would you want to be on this show? And we would pick the people for you based on your list of what you wanted. And here we are.
So to reiterate, it's a show where people are competing to be the father of a baby who's for a woman who's 41 and freezing her eggs.
Yes, but in theory, I want to mention they're not competing to definitely do it. Mm-hmm. See, I think that's part of what gets lost in the translation. It's more about setting them up and seeing what happens. And I'm there to remind her that she does not have to pick anybody. Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, I think the most interesting thing about this show is your role in conjunction with the woman. Because, for instance, if you watch The Bachelor, Chris Harrison is supposed to be sympathetic to The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, but he's not really like a confidant per se, whereas you are acting almost as like there's like a midwife characteristic to you. did you know when going in that you would have to take on this super empathetic part of the show?
It would have been harder not to do that. Like, I was concerned that they wanted me to be Chris Harrison or even Jeff Probst. If you think about like the super successful host, and they're very like straight faced and like kind of calm, authoritative, like, you know, I don't know what they are exactly. They're like an aloof parent, kind of like. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not, I didn't know how I was going to do that. So I said, you guys, I'm going to try to keep my opinions to myself, because obviously I'm not Christy and I'm not living her life. But on the other hand, I might have some opinions, and what am I going to do? And they said, just be yourself. And I was like, okay, oh my God.
I will say, by the way, that like the hosting role suits you. As much as I was sitting here like absorbing the concept of the show and like in shock in particular where the first episode goes, I think you really are comfortable doing it. Did you expect to be comfortable just helming a show like this?
I'm not comfortable. I'm so nervous. I have a little, you know, earpiece, and I have a producer who I love so much, who's like, you know, a wonderful woman. And I'm talking to her in my mic, which is right here. And I'm like, help me, help me. But they cut that part out, right? I'm comfortable with the subject matter. And I felt comfortable with our producers because most of us have been involved for a long time. So I knew what we were going for. And it was a very fascinating process. I mean, I've never been around reality TV. I had no real understanding of the fact that they literally never turn the cameras off. I was just like, well, I'd turn around, there'd be like 50 cameras. I'd be like, turn them off, cut. They never did. They never cut. So like that first episode, I was like, cut it. No. Didn't happen.
I mean, well, even just speaking of this show being on Fox and being wild and subject matter, one of my favorite television shows, more so than Sex and the City, to be honest, is Melrose Place.
Ah!
I started watching it with my mom at a younger age. She was watching it, and I was far too young to be watching this show, but I would see it every week when she watched it. And recently, I think in quarantine too, so many other friends of mine have been discovering the show. There's so many people tweeting about watching it and just being amazed with, you know, this sort of time capsule of the 90s, right?
Oh, very much. Very much. I did not realize that was happening. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah, a lot of new people discovering Melrose. And it's just sort of,
wow.
How was that, like pre-Sex in the City? So, Ooh. You know, like how was yeah. that subject matter, especially during that time, you know, you're doing all sorts of crazy storylines. And it was sort of an introduction, you know, sort of post-Dynasty era, but like to younger people in America watching the mm-hmm, kind of crazy mm-hmm. stuff that I feel like is commonplace on TV now.
Well, that's a good point, Ira. This is why I follow you on Twitter. I love your takes. So when I got Brooke on Melrose Place, it was at the height of the show. So for me, I was just beyond thrilled and excited that someone was going to pay me to go work. And I had so much enthusiasm. And, you know, it was slightly misplaced in that culture. Because they weren't really an enthusiastic bunch, really, to tell you the truth. So it was interesting. And I really wanted to be good, you know, which was also like kind of odd for them. Like, I hope he doesn't get mad at me. I think I've said this before, but Andrew Hsu would say, like, we'd be in the makeup trailer and he'd be like, listen, when we go in there, do not try to move around the set. I was like, you mean you don't want to do blocking? And he'd be like, no. And I'd be like, but we have to move around. It's weird. And he was like, don't do it. We'll be here all day. And I was like, but you know, I've been in acting class for like 15 years. I really want to, you know, do some stuff. And like one time I went to the props department and I was like, listen, I'm working in this office. And I thought maybe I could have a notebook and I could have a pen because, you know, Brooke really wants to be an excellent assistant. She's trying to, you know, it's like that All About Eve storyline. And I was trying to, you know, succeed. And they were like, no, no props. And I was like, why? Why? And they said, well, because then you would look down. And I was like, yes, but, you know, in offices, people might look down. I could hold it up kind of like this. And they were like, no, no, Mr. Spelling wants to see your eyes.
Oh, wow. Like he had a sort of,
I know.
When I always talk about how, like, Merv Griffin hired Vanna White and Pat Sajak for Wheel of Fortune because he said their heads were too big for their body. And I would, like, are people who are in charge of TV, like, obsessed with, like, we've got to be looking at the eyes? Like, the eyes are where the money is.
The eyes is where the money is. And I'll tell you, as a producer of Labor of Love and a host, sometimes I'd be like, Christy, look up. Like, it gets in the back of your head. And I'm like, you got to look up, baby, look up. We don't know how you feel. But, yeah, it was a little bit of an extreme version of that, you know? So it's kind of hard for me. And also they kind of couldn't decide what they wanted Brooke to be or do. Mm-hmm. So I would fluctuate. Like sometimes there'd be like a comedic episode, which I really enjoyed. And then they were like, now you're going to kill yourself. And I'd be like, why? What do you mean? I mean, it was the whole thing was just a trip and a half. And I think we were doing, I want to say 26 episodes a year, a season, something crazy. So it was like a factory. And you were in your slot and you had to like really do well, or at least that's how I felt. And then after a while, they were like, we don't know what to do with you anymore. And I was like, that's okay. I mean, you know, I get it.
Yeah, you know, they had you trip and fall and hit your head on the side of the pool, drown, and then you came back as a ghost.
I know, and I love that episode. It's my all-time favorite. The two together. I loved when I fell because none of us had any body fat because we weren't really allowed to have any body fat, and they couldn't get me to sink to the bottom of the pool, so they had to weight me down like I was wearing like body weights under my clothes, and then my hair, you know, goes like up like a mermaid. I love that. And then I come back, and I get to be an evil ghost and mess with Billy. Oh, I really enjoy that.
I mean, we'll get to Sex and the City in a moment, but like, have you had any lasting impact of being on Melrose? Like, do people talk to you about that show still?
People talk to me, sure. Yeah, they definitely do. And I hadn't thought about it. I haven't been out that much lately, obviously, but we'll see. I do feel like there were younger people talking to me about it lately-ish, where I'm always surprised. I mean, that's what's great about a career. You know, if you're lucky enough to get to work and you do this character and you do that character and you think it's all going to be Charlotte, you know, obviously, and a lot of it is, but then there's other things that connect with people and you don't know what it's going to be. And I like that part.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Darren Star still involved in Melrose when you joined?
Yeah.
And is that how Sex and the City came about for you?
Yeah. And I literally had to do whatever Darren asked me to do for like 10 years. I'm giving me my first two jobs. I gave Darren so many awards for charities and, you know, whatever, which is fine. That's how it works. But yes, Darren hired me at Melrose. And I think he perceived Brooke as being a little bit funny. Mm-hmm. But then he left.
Yeah.
And I was like, who gets me here? I don't know. And I think that's part of the reason they didn't know what to do with me. And then he did another show that didn't work. And then he went to HBO and decided to change things up a bit. Mm-hmm. Sex and the City happened.
Yeah.
He sent it to me, told me to read Carrie. I was like, no, I can't. I'm not. I can't. I'm not her. I'm this other one that you don't write a lot about. And then luckily I got it.
Yeah. I think that other show was Central Park West, wasn't it?
Yes.
Imagine Ira not knowing that.
Good job. That was his first New York foray.
Okay, when I think of Sex and the City, it's a show, obviously, I mean, like, we're gay men, it comes up a lot just anyway, but in the way that I think about, like, The Devil Wears Prada, or maybe even Clueless, there are some things that when they come on TV, I have no choice but to watch whatever is put in front of me.
Aww.
And but, like, I don't feel that way about any other TV show, and I was wondering, what do you think it is about that show that immediately settles people in? Like, why do I want to just, like, live in that show like it's a soup every time it's on?
I think it's magic.
Yeah. Good
I really
answer.
Do. I do. I have a friend, and he has a mom who's an artist, and she's really, like, she lives in the woods, and she's not really, like, a pop culture person. And a long time ago, she said this to me. We were at the opening of Shakespeare in the Park that he was starring in, and she turned to me and she said, "You know, I watch your show." And I said, "Wow, thank you. I'm so surprised." She said, "I don't know why." I said, I understand. And she said, "You know, I think it's the colors."
All right.
Okay. You know, whatever. I mean, I just think there's, like, a weird alchemy that can happen or not happen, obviously. And you can't really necessarily control it. And I think that we had that. And I think it has to do with the four of us, but I think it also has to do with our writers, who were incredible. And I know you can, you know, criticize the puns and whatever, which you guys have done, which I'm aware of, but that's okay.
Oh, we're a pun making group, okay. By the way. Nobody here is mad about that. Yeah.
It's okay. I mean, it's an interesting thing that, like, people want to say, like, and I don't know if you know Woke Charlotte. Do you know Woke Charlotte?
Oh, yeah.
On Instagram.
Yeah, I love Woke Charlotte, which is amazing. But, like, we were you know, in the times that we were in, right, we were definitely in and of them. And I feel like we were progressive for those times. And we could be so much more progressive now, of course, potentially. I don't know. But whatever. It is what it is. And I can't explain it.
No, you know, it's definitely from an era where women's television still wasn't really being taken seriously, if people take it more seriously now. You know, like, I love Emily Nussbaum's essay about Sex and the City, you know, sort of about Carrie as an anti-hero in, you know, the sort of way of Tony Soprano, you know, Walter White.
I forgot about that. That's right.
Yeah. And it is just sort of that show that, first of all, it's always on.
Right. No, by the way, if there are people who haven't seen Sex and the City by now, like, you don't own a television. It's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, this past weekend, it was just on TV. I was passing by the TV, and the Kirsten Johnson falling out the window episode was there. And, of course, I had to sit down and watch the entire thing.
Dark, though. That one hurts me. I don't personally watch it because, to me, I remember so intensely, like, whatever was going on, or how hot we were, or how tired we were, or whatever. You know, I remember so much of it because the whole experience was just so incredibly intense. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because just recently, I worked with someone, a hair person, who said, you know, "I'm going to hot roll your hair." And I was like, "Well, I don't think we need to put hot rollers in my hair." And she said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to look like Shirley Temple, and then I'm going to look like Charlotte when it starts to fall." She said, "Who's Charlotte?" And I was like, What do I do here? It was really a dilemma. And I still don't really, it's like such an odd thing. It's a very odd thing to feel like that's you, but it's not you. And then people are like, in your industry, say they don't, it's rare, but occasionally when they do say they don't know, you're just like, I don't know how to talk to this person.
Charlotte's your language. Yeah.
It's true. Charlotte is, it's certainly my hair language, right? Like, there's either Charlotte hair or Charlotte non-hair.
One of my favorite, I think, Instagram posts just ever is you posted a picture one time just with Cynthia. I think it was after The Little Foxes, which she was doing on Broadway at the time.
Uh-huh.
Now, yeah. Obviously, like, Cynthia's journey in the public eye has been so one of a kind. You had the New York Governor run, and she's just a rad defender of public schooling, et cetera.
Yes.
Can you just talk about being friends with her? Because when you posted that picture with her, I'm like, I'm not somebody who thinks about the cast of Friends. Are they friends in real life? I don't care. But, like, the fact that you and her seem to have some sort of kinship struck me as particularly awesome.
Yes. Thank you. I feel particularly lucky that we have kinship. I mean, we have so many similarities and so many differences, but we're kind of only children. We she lived like two blocks from me. Like we would ride to work together. Like the fact that we're different somehow helped us. Like I have this one picture with, if it didn't cause a lot of drama, I would post it, but I'm standing behind her on set. It's a Polaroid and she's standing in front of me and she's like mean mommy, like defending me. And I'm like meek, like in the background. And there were a lot of times that that happened, you know, and then there were a lot of times where, because she's so strong, people don't realize, you know, what she may be feeling. So then I would need to go and kind of advocate for her sometimes. And we have a good balance of that. And we would vacation together. And I mean, this is true for a lot of us. And I don't want to get into any of the drama, obviously. But behind the scenes, our crew, our cast, like we had an incredible situation. And what we went through was so intense that it really bonded us, you know, and Cynthia and I certainly, like I was just at her house right before the lockdown, to the point where I was like, did I bring it back from New York to LA? I don't know. But I didn't. We're all fine. We've been tested. But I you know, I love her passionately. I support her in all of her work. I think she's incredibly brave and amazing. And I'm glad that it made you happy.
You know, for my New Year's party, I had the idea to like use Polaroids.
Ooh, I love them.
It was just reminding me of the fact that like, yes, when you brought that up, the concept of we're all constantly taking photos of ourselves with friends with phones. And then I think about the treasure trove that people must have of just old photos. Because it's not like people didn't take photos constantly then. You just had to
develop them.
Put them on a camera and develop them later.
Exactly. And on set, obviously, we would take continuity photos and we would take hair and makeup photos and we would take costume photos all on Polaroid. And I remember one time at the end of, possibly at the end of the show, they were going to throw them all out. And I was like, oh, I want some. So I have this big box here at my house, Polaroids, which I love.
I love that.
I know.
When are we going to see you work with Darren again?
Good question.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know what Darren is doing. Do you know what Darren is doing?
I mean, there's, I don't know. There's
we
younger.
Need to mention Michael Patrick King.
Yes.
Oh, younger. Right. I don't think I can be on younger, which is great. And I'm happy for them. But I think it's too similar. Don't
yeah.
you, Ira?
A little bit. Yeah. I have two friends who work on it. And I particularly love the Darren flourish in when you're watching a show of his and you remember yes. that he created like Melrose Place, because the Kristen Johnson scene, right? Like there'll be random scenes in his non-Melrosey shows where just like something like that'll happen. I believe someone was blackmailing True. Sutton Foster in Younger in one season. And
wow.
then a beam from construction falls and kills them. And that's Whoa. How the story wrapped up. And it's just funny
Crazy.
Things like that.
Well, the thing is that Darren loved us, you know, his thing is like of the moment, right? Like he mm-hmm. likes the moment. And so sometimes he'll go to the next thing that he feels is of the moment. And he left us with Michael Patrick King, who is in my mm-hmm. mind, a genius and I love him dearly. And I think he was in charge when Kristen fell out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a dark thing from his mind, possibly. But we also had 8 other women writers, which they, you know, don't get enough credit. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank that. You so much, Kristen, for joining
Wait,
us.
Wait, we're done? No. Yeah.
Kristen.
I mean, what else do you want to say?
Well, remember, I just want to mention that back when I was supposed to be on the first time, when my house almost burned down, and I just couldn't string 2 sentences together, and you guys intimidate me too much to try to be Uh-oh. On when I can't think straight. I know. Well, because you're smart, you know. We were going to talk about Holiday in the Wild on Netflix. Oh,
the elephant movie.
The
it was elephant. Very funny.
I'm glad you liked it. So I just feel like, because I wanted you guys to say it, because I was so excited that you wanted to talk about it, because it was special. And, you know, those were real elephants that were rescued. And I was so lucky to get to go do it. You know.
I have just always been an elephant fan. And also, it's my... my mom's favorite animal.
Love it.
As a child, constantly, there were just always like elephant figurines in the house. And I remember that was a very easy gift to get my mom, an elephant something.
Love it.
The same way that...
I have a lot of elephants.
Yeah. The same way I always got my grandmother Betty Boop things. It's like, it's nice knowing when your parent is really into one particular thing and you can just
totally.
Get the same gift every year. Very
no, totally, my mom mentioned to one person in 1979 that she likes stuffed animal mice, and now our entire house looks like it's infested. It's like every Christmas is frightening. Yeah, yeah.
That's intense. I love elephants.
Your mom is Mrs. Frisbee.
Yesterday, ordered a new one. I ordered a new little elephant statue yesterday. So I feel you. I'm there. I love it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on Keep It. You know, we're such fans of you.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
You're amazing. You guys are great. And I love all of you. And, you know, best of luck.
Thank you again for joining us, Kristen. And you can all check out Labor of Love on Fox every Thursday night.
Doors take us to summers away. Or winter adventures and afternoon getaways. Your dedicated Fidelity advisor can help you open those doors by working with you on a comprehensive plan to help you reach your wealth's full potential. Because doors were meant to be opened. Visit fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimum supply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
And I am extra excited to have Issa Rae here today, literally just a couple weeks after our Cosmo story came out. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for that, by the way. It was such a flattering article. I'm happy to be here.
Issa, you need to stop legitimizing Ira's journalism career. It disturbs me. We can take him down one peg at a time if you refuse stories like this.
I'm sorry. He just does it so well. He's holding it. Oh, I did it again. Look at me.
Had
I can't,
to be seen, yes.
Can't help it.
Yes, thanks for joining us, Issa.
Thank you.
So when I called you to do some follow-ups, you were debating whether or not to start Insecure Season 5 Writer's Room via Zoom, and now you're doing it, yeah?
Full-fledged. It's not via Zoom, but it is via it's via Google Meet, which is struggling. I'm going to be honest. It's not any better than Zoom. It's so... it's such a challenge. Like, today it really... I feel like it hit us all, because I think we're gearing towards the end of week three, and it is taking its toll on us, for sure.
Yeah, so we literally just wrapped the show that I was writing on, and I think I was telling you that, like, this whole real world now that we're in of, like, writing TV shows and meeting with writers over the internet, it's even more taxing, I feel like, than a regular 20 weeks of just sitting in a room, kicking in with each other.
Definitely.
Constantly staring at people.
Staring at yourself?
How is it changing?
Yeah.
How is it changing your, like, your workflow, like, your just ability to come up with new ideas?
It's definitely made us more efficient, but to the ideas of it, like, so many of our ideas come from our writers living and going out. And this is such an LA-based show. It's so weird to not be able to roam the streets of LA. And even thinking about locations and things that we'd like to feature, that it's just, we're not going anywhere. So we've been talking about, I don't know if this is the case in your room, with your show, I don't know if it applies, but, like, the COVID of it, we've been talking about whether or not we want to acknowledge it.
Ooh,
that's,
yes.
That's even more depressing.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, because ours was animated, and so, and we already sort of broke the season. We were 2 months in before we had to go into COVID. But, yeah, wondering for creators now, such as yourself, like, are producers, like, even HBO, like, even asking you, like, hey, what do you think, like, COVID would be like on TV, you know? Or is that just a question amongst yourself?
Right now, it's a question amongst ourselves. We're actually going to present our season arc to the network probably like next week or something. And I do wonder if it'll come up, but they've never been like ones to suggest things. And I feel like everybody's going to have fatigue. Like, do y'all want to watch COVID stories on TV right now?
No. I do have to say no. I do have to say no. Do you have to find like other like... inventive ways to be inspired, like all three of us are writers on TV shows actually, and like walking around the block, for example, not doing it for me. Like, I need to find more ways to generate things to write about.
Yeah, there's definitely that. I mean, it's a lot of taking from past stories and recounting past things, but absolutely not feeling inspired by looking at the same plants and houses that I've been looking at for, you know, 2.5 months now.
You know, like the beyond even figuring out whether to mention COVID in the show, whether to like allow it to, you know, permeate the script, whatever. It's like, how are you guys writing and keeping that stamina when we don't even know if we can produce the shows that we're writing on right now, you know?
Well, what's crazy is we were just talking about today, like LA's talking, not LA's county, but they're talking about resuming production on Monday. So it feels like people are going the way of, if you're going to die, you're going to die. It's
just sad. But I got to watch my show. I got to get into it.
Sorry. It's just, it's so disrespectful. So I think I was dealing with that before. I was just like, why are we doing this? We don't even know when we're going to start. But everybody seems so pressed to start that now I'm kind of just like, well, hold up. Excuse me. Yeah.
We've seen protests around the U.S. Like, we are just like weeks, I think, from actors protesting outside Paramount, being like, we want to shoot.
If they don't sit down, I mean, I can't even fault them, but if I guess it's going to get to a point where it's like, if you want to risk your life, then risk it. If only Tyler Perry were Paramount and WB and were flying people private and putting them up, then maybe we'd feel more certain, but everybody doesn't have Tyler Perry coins.
Yeah.
Actually, yes, they do. They do have Tyler Perry.
They're just not using them.
They're just not using them. Exactly.
A fascinating thing to me always is when people who become known for generating their own material, writing for themselves, end up taking just like acting projects, as you have in this movie Lovebirds with Kumail. Like every time I watch a Tina Fey movie that she didn't write, or Mindy Kaling, I'm thinking like, do you have to tap into a part of your brain that didn't exist before? Like, now I'm just like a for-hire person here to do a job. Does it feel completely alien in some respects, or do you end up loving it more in different reasons?
In some ways, I end up loving it more because, especially with Lovebirds and The Photograph, I was coming just off of Insecure, and so much of that is... Wait, what? Am I lying? I think I was. Yeah, I was. I was coming. It felt so long on it. But I was coming straight off of that. So it felt like a break of having to wear so many hats and you're just executing someone else's vision. But for sure, you're asking questions about the script. You're like, I'm still trying to give creative input when it's allowed. But I kind of have to wash my hands of, okay, this is the director's vision. This is the writer's vision. So I'm just, you know, executing what they want at the end of the day. And so it does become a bit easier to divorce myself from that until the movie comes out.
Mm-hmm. I, like, have, of course, always been a huge Issa Rae fan, you know, coming up watching Insecure from its inception and even when it was on the internet. And then watching Kumail separately, big stand-up fan, watching his career and the way he came up, Franklin and Bash, all the fun stuff. I want to ask you, because it's so weird for these two worlds to meet in my head. I did not imagine that this would happen ever. So what was it like working with Kumail and how was that rapport on set?
I love working with him. I feel like, you know, I made a friend. We think similarly, we're very similar, but he's just so smart and he's so incredibly witty and he just forces you to step up your comedic game naturally just because he's a beast and he's not satisfied until he has like at least 10 alternate jokes. And there's something rewarding about working with him. And I like you, like I had watched him. I remember when I was living in New York, I used to listen to Fresh Air on my commute all the time. And I remember listening to an interview with him and feeling like, oh, this dude seems cool. Like and that was just when he was early in his stand-up career.
Yeah.
And to work with him is just something I never expected, but I'm so happy we did.
Yeah. I really found that like, it's interesting trying to create a chemistry too, like with a new actor, you know, because it's interesting how you on Insecure, you know, obviously you've been working for multiple seasons on the show now, you know, so like you get to discover new relationships that actors have just from seeing them interact in scenes. You know, how do you go about creating sort of that vibe with Kumail, with Lakeith and The Photograph, you know, like going about, this is a new person that I have to give romance to, you know, like make it look palpable on the screen for people, you know? So like sort of what's your process for getting to know these people and being comfortable?
With The Photograph, you know, that happened fairly quickly, but Lakeith and I had you know, met before and worked with each other briefly on other projects and, you know, been at some of the same parties. So it was just like we're kind of going into it. And the movie luckily granted for us meeting for the first time. And the first scene that we shot was us meeting for the first time. And so we were kind of getting to know each other and get our groove while the movie was happening. And with something like The Lovebirds, Kumail and I were kind of redeveloping and discussing the script behind the scenes in pre-production up until the project. And so we were spending a lot of time together talking with the producers, talking with the writers, and obviously to each other, just in terms of things that we wanted to be clear in the dynamic between this couple. And by way of doing that, we were sharing personal stories. So we were really getting to know each other and getting to know our sense of humor. And I think spent more time together before shooting than I feel like I've done on any of the other projects. Mm-hmm. Whereas Insecure, you know, you're doing table reads and things like that, but you're kind of just getting to know each other on set too. But with the show, mm-hmm. with regulars, obviously it's different. If it's like a Nathan or a Lawrence or a Daniel, like, you know, you're working together so much, you're getting used to each other.
Mm-hmm. In this movie, I feel like the style of the comedy tends to run delirious. And not that Insecure doesn't have, like, silly moments, but to me, the feel of this is so frenetic. And I was wondering what kind of learning curve there was to nailing it, or if it takes you an extra take to, you know, get to that kind of Animaniac-like speed of this movie.
Mm-hmm. It definitely was a balance of, okay, this is what is funny on the page, but this is also what I find funny. Mm-hmm. So what's the balance, you know? And so it's a lot of conversations. And it's also a lot of, frankly, like, oh, no, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think it's a polite, like, oh, no, thanks. I don't feel like either this character would do this, or it's just not necessarily my style or aim of humor. And it, luckily, you know, you have a director who's like, okay, well, I threw it out there and you didn't want mm-hmm. it. And otherwise it's like, oh yeah, I don't know if I can do this, but I'm willing to try it. Mm-hmm. And then the director is like, oh, thank you for trying that, but no, I agree, you couldn't do it. Or, oh, that worked, you know? So it's just, it's definitely freeing. And when you know that the movie's intention or the tone is supposed to be a specific way, then you try to just kind of fit within that.
Speaking of the tone, and like, it's funny because we all are comedy writers in our own way. Mm-hmm. Me, like, watching the movie and trying to figure out what's funny and how it's funny. And like he said, it's kind of slapsticky in animaniac sort of way. But when you and Kumail were finding your dynamic and finding, like, when you were rewriting the script in pre-production, when you were trying to figure out how you were funny together, where were you leaning toward? Because, like, we know in Insecure right now, it's you and Molly having a lot of conflict. But it's funny to watch, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, what is it with Kumail?
He loves, like, certain things to feel real. And that's kind of one of the, I won't say battles, but one of the things that we were constantly discussing is just wanting the couple to feel real and the stakes to also feel real. And so, you know, whether or not that happened, those were just constant discussions that we were having. And I think he leans towards, if this scene is supposed to be funny, then it needs to have options to be funny. So that meant, like, okay, let's do another take, or let's try it this way, or let's just have alternates, let's have the real grounded version. And if the director wants, you know, a version that feels more, a little bit bigger, then let's try that. But let's always do the version that you and I want. And I there's something about that I like, because at the end of the day, you're leaving the film knowing, well, I know they got takes, they have a variety of takes to choose from.
Speaking too, just of like what Aida brought up, the whole Molly and Issa of it all in Insecure, there's been so much conversation, obviously, around them. You know, it feels like reminiscent of season one when there were Team Lawrence versus Team Issa. Now, you know, there's Team Molly, Team Issa conversations. What was your reasoning for just wanting to dive into female friendship, especially Black female friendship, in a way that we haven't seen on television before, and the sort of readiness to show how fraught it can be and show the ugly sides of both characters? Were you sort of nervous about doing this and how people might react to it? And did you feel that it was still ultimately like a necessary story you needed to tell?
All of the above. It was the series was naturally building to this. It's something that is true to my own life. You know, I've gone through 2.5 friendship breakups, 2 that were like of between me and the friend, and the third was just watching two of my closest friends break up, and they're very real and they're so painful. And they, you know, I've said before, have been more painful than any breakup that I've dealt with. You know, I'm still reeling from some of my female friendship breakups today. And I think I haven't seen them portrayed much and with nuance in a way where it's just like not necessarily one-sided. And there's so many factors. Like in those friendship breakups, there, it's never been one thing. It's either been we're tallying history, a history of things, or there's a communication breakdown. So we wanted to just explore the different facets between these two characters. And also, these breakups that I've had have happened when we're just in different seasons of life. And we're, you know, the dynamic in the friendship may have changed and we haven't had a chance to acknowledge it or understand what that means to defining our relationship and if that even matters and why it matters. And they're just, you know, all of that felt very interesting to explore. And, you know, even in going around the writer's room, we all had, at least all the women had stories about, you know, tragic friendship breakups. And we wanted to incorporate that. It just felt like interesting story to tell.
Yeah, I mean, not that we're sort of like the same, obviously, but, you know, I think like Lewis and I can even attest to, you know, like, gay men who have relationships, you know, that are sort of very close, closer, when we don't understand straight men relationships. I don't know.
I'm not curious.
Do they? But this idea of, you know, it feels very universal. And I think especially in a time now, it's just great seeing that representation. It feels a lot like even the show Dead to Me. Currently, you know, just like this exploration of women on cable TV that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, absolutely. I just finished Dead to Me. But to the straight men of it, it's so funny because I have gotten, because people love to tell me their opinions about the show. And a lot of straight men have hit me up like, what the fuck, this season is trash. And I've been like, okay, but y'all can't relate. You can't, and that's okay. It's not for you because y'all have trash, non-communicative friendships, or like so many males are just content, like, cutting people off and moving on or not expressing their feelings and moving on. And it's just like, those aren't, either you take all the traits of your toxic friends and just internalize them or put a wall up, or you just cut them off and go on your merry way. It's so interesting, the difference between male friendships, straight male friendships, and female friendships.
Who are these straight men jumping up with these horrible insights? How do we shut them down?
How do we stop them from talking? To be honest, Issa, I sent this trailer to so many of my like Middle Eastern bays that I was trying to hit on. Like, this could be us. You know what I mean? Like that conversation of, and especially me being a black Muslim kid, never thinking that I would see a Southeast Asian person, a Pakistani person with a black woman in an interracial romance. Like I couldn't even fathom that would have happened. And, you know, have you felt like there's been a conversation around the interracial casting, or has it been accepted in a hopefully like calm way?
I think it's a little of both. I think some people are just like, ugh, finally, like, you know, a non-white interracial couple, you know, it's just like, it's such an obvious thing to do. And, you know, we've seen it a couple of times and things like that, but it's just not, it's not as common as it should be. It doesn't reflect the world.
Mississippi Masala.
Ooh, that's like, yes. Denzel.
That is a movie, Aida. You need to see it. It's iconic.
Yeah, it is. It's
Denzel.
Mississippi Masala. Off title alone.
One of the sexiest movies you'll ever see.
Yeah, and that was like 30 years ago or something. So it's just like, that was the last like black Southeast Asian representation that we've seen on screen. So Pakistani Denzel is Kumail, so like he's holding it down.
I was just like browsing through just times I've seen you in movies and TV and stuff, and I remembered like, oh yeah, you were the voice in the Oscar-winning Short Hair Love, and you, of course, you were in The Hate U Give, which has just like chock full of awesome performances. And it made me wonder, what's been your greatest on-set acting lesson from another actor?
Watching Amanla, I'll never forget, we were like filming The Hate U Give, and this is not, it wasn't a conversation, it was more of an observation. But obviously during, when you're shooting, there's time between setups. So I remember we were shooting this big riot scene where she gets super emotional and stands on top of a car and has to channel this anger and this frustration and this tearful, like, Khalil lives. And right before that, right before we were setting that up, she was showing me videos in a car with two of the other actors, and we were just cracking up laughing and talking shit. And then the director was like, okay, it's time to do this scene. And I was like, oh my God, we really were out the zone here. I hope that she can get to it. And then this bitch just gets on the car and just delivers the performance of a lifetime. And then we have to do another setup and we're back in that car. And she's like, okay, cool. And then even between those takes, we were still like, I was trying to like not crack jokes so she could stay in the zone. And she was like cracking a joke and then would go back to a tearful performance. So I was like, oh, wow. In that moment, I was like, actors are psychopaths. And I don't like that. That's something that I need to, you know, tap into in some way and learn. And so I'm always watching different people's processes and just, you know, the more and more I work and the more I take on, I want to be able to find my own.
Catherine O'Hara has stories of being in a movie with Meryl Streep. And before Meryl would launch into, you know, a Meryl-sized take, she would just be talking about anything and not even thinking about it and then launch right back into it. So anyway, don't mean to say Amanda is necessarily the next Meryl, but they are apparently the same person.
You just did it. Also, Catherine O'Hara is a genius and hilarious. Yes. So, I mean, if she's intimidated by Meryl, then what is there?
When Amanda died, in Hunger Games, I was like, oh, girl. Oh, I know you got it. You are set for life.
Yeah.
Like, stole the movie.
My God.
We literally just had Andre Holland on the show a couple weeks ago, and they were together in the Eddy, and he was even talking about just how, like, scary amazing she is on set.
Andre Holland?
The streets are talking.
Yes, yes.
Jeez. Yeah, she's a gift. She's got it.
Speaking of, like, Lewis brought up your voice acting. This was a story that I wanted to ask you about that we talked about for the Cosmo interview that didn't actually make it to print. I was asking you about you voicing LAX.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
In Little?
You go to LAX and they use voices of actors who live here. Yeah. You know, like Danny Trejo, Allison Janney are a couple of the others. And there's also your voice. So, like, can you tell us how that came about and just how surreal it was hearing your voice for the first time?
Oh, man, it's so crazy. I do some work with the city via something called Destination Crenshaw, which is kind of combating gentrification in that area. And so they just randomly hit me up to be like, hey, do you want to be one of the voices for LAX? And I didn't really know what that meant. And they were just like, you know, we'd love for you to do it. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And did it in 10 minutes one day, you know, in between Insecure shooting in a studio. And then 4 months later was getting texts like, bitch, is this your voice that I hear in the airport? Like, what is? And I was like, what? This is, it rolled out. And it's crazy. Like, I would get hit up about it all the time, but I never heard it until the craziest LA experience in my life. And I already told you about this, but like the Sundance getting off the plane, got the news that Kobe passed, obviously on the plane with everyone else, and was devastated. And we were all just kind of reeling from the news. And then I was the first one to get off the plane. And, you know, I was fighting back tears and walking off. You're seeing people in LAX also looking like zombies looking at the screen. And as soon as I walk off the plane, I hear my own voice welcoming me to the airport. And it was it was so weird. I was like, this is, you can't write this bad symbolic, I don't know, whatever.
It's too on the nose.
It was too on the nose. But it was just, it was surreal. And yeah, then I haven't heard it since. Well, I haven't been in an airport either.
Yeah.
We're staying out of the airport.
Hello. But some people are not. I hate everybody. I don't know how y'all are dealing with it, but people are being a little bit too lenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember, like, when we had first chatted, like, there were still people, like, hanging out at the parks before Garcetti was like, I'm not having that. Shut down the parks. And I guess, like, finally, like, how was your quarantine been aside from like the Insecure? Like, what's been your like self-care routine? What's like helped you get through this time?
Walking around the neighborhood for sure. Baths, swimming, like when I can, talking to my family every Sunday. has been a blessing. I was like, oh man, I really don't talk to my family. Like, I don't talk to my siblings all the time. And now we've made it, you know, we've made appointments to catch up and I get to see my niece and nephews more often just on a screen than I normally do. So that's been the best part about it. But beyond that, it's been pretty terrible.
I concur. Right. You're onto something there. Yeah.
Pretty awful.
I think you guys do.
But you seem like you're doing well enough with it. And we're really excited for the end of Insecure and whatever y'all cook up for season 5.
Well, thank you so, so much. I appreciate y'all for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for
Have
coming.
A great rest of your evening.
You too, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. But once again, it's one of those weeks where it's hard to say that because we did just interview Issa Rae and Kristen Davis.
True. We did the hard work. Somebody had to do it. Grueling.
But regardless, here we go, trying to make this the best segment of the week as usual. Lewis, what's your keep it?
First of all, minor keep it. To whatever the fuck RuPaul was wearing on the RuPaul's Drag Race reunion special last week.
Bitch, what the fuck was that?
It was scary.
Looking like,
I did not like it.
Looking like a 1971 Spider-Man villain.
Yes, right. No, truly, I mean, to invoke a super tired cliche, Party City mask. But RuPaul's Drag Race had the reunion for the most recent season, which was, of course, conducted over Zoom. It was actually a pretty tightly edited experience. Ru spoke exclusively in pre-written one-liners, so it was pretty slick.
Yeah.
But Ru herself...
It was like NeNe at a Housewives reunion.
Right. No, I can tell this has been workshopped. So Ru hosted the whole thing. It was sleepover-themed. Everybody was kind of in sweats and stuff. But Ru's outfit... And Ru usually hosts the reunions out of drag, so that's not a surprise or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was wearing a purple hoodie, generic. I wanted to say congratulations to American Apparel. I don't know who made that arrangement. And then underneath it, he is wearing this cyan face mask, which, by the way, doesn't go with the purple hoodie, period. And then secondly, has nothing to do with anything we expect of Ru in the looks department. I kept trying to solve it. Was it that he doesn't want to do makeup or like... He didn't prepare his face
in any way.
Right. Is that it? I don't know.
Did he forget how to do his own makeup circa 2002?
Right.
Probably.
Yeah, it's shocking.
I mean, because it also ties into the fact that, you know, we know that Ru doesn't do drag for public appearances except for extra money. Ru just seems to be tired of drag in general.
Yeah. I mean, I keep thinking of that look and just thinking this is the most remarkably, one, bland RuPaul look, and two, underwhelming.
It's like when he had his talk show. I love the original 90s one, but like, why would you tune into the recent daytime RuPaul talk show when he's not in drag?
Yeah, right.
It's just sort of like, there's this whole disconnect now between the RuPaul that we were promised and the RuPaul that RuPaul now wants to be.
Correct, correct. But my real keep it this week is to a phenomenon that I do find amusing, and I'm happy it's happening, but we need to diversify the name in question. And by that I mean, the word Karen has gotten out of control. Everybody knows that word now. Your aunt knows that word. People named Karen are now calling other Karens Karens. It's very confusing. And here's the thing. It's a funny name. People who are that age, who are complaining to the manager, who are getting caught on tape, whatever, treating their pets terribly or whatever the fuck goes viral these days with people named Karen, is correct. I believe Karens often do that. However, you know I gotta rep Karen Carpenter right now, arguably my favorite musician of all time. Remember, when you use the name Karen, you also slander Karen Carpenter, and this is why I would like to suggest other Karen alternatives. Pam is out there. Think about Pam. Do you know a Pam you like? Pamela Anderson. It's been years since she kept us fed. I'm about ready to give that one up. Phyllis. We haven't had a wonderful Phyllis since 1973 in Cloris Leachman. In the wake of Mrs. America with Phyllis Schlafly, happy to resume that. And please don't forget Helen. Helen, very unimportant name at this point. Mm. Ever since Helen Slater, I've been underwhelmed with the Helen community. And I say that with affection to my own Aunt Helen. Hi, Aunt Helen.
I mean, even raising Helen really did not give us anything.
Liz Phair was on that soundtrack, and I said, that's too bad. I'm angry.
I mean, R.I.P. Brittany Murphy, but it was a mess.
I only realized in the past 3 years that Raising Helen is a play on Raising Hell.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Also, Brittany Murphy is not in that movie. I'm an idiot. I'm thinking of Little Black Book.
Oh, around that time, sure.
Yes. That one was Kate Hudson and Hayden Panettiere.
Right. Hayden Panettiere, movie star we forget about. Other than Scream 4, where I do believe she killed it.
I really need her to be alive for Scream 5. We didn't see the body.
That's true. Also, there are no rules in that universe. People will come back. Whatever. Bring back Jamie Kennedy. Who cares?
Yeah, I really thought he would have been the killer in Scream 3. Would have been better.
Yeah.
Anyway, my keep it this week involves Karens.
Get out.
My keep it is to the internet canceling everything.
Oh my.
here's the thing.
Hold on. Let me laugh at the basicness of this already. Go on.
We have a situation where an actual canceling needed to occur. You know, there was the viral video this week of an Amy Cooper who was called a Karen, threatening to call the police on a black man in the park for telling her that her dog was off leash in an area where dogs are supposed to be kept on their leashes. In the video, she specifically tells the police, like, I'm being threatened by an African-American man. You know, at this point, white women who call the police on black people, specifically using it as a threat, like, know what's going to happen, right? Like, you're essentially wishing that this person were dead. That is an instance where, yes, cancel the fuck out of this, Heffa. Unfortunately, this cancellation is happening amidst everyone being bored out of their fucking minds during quarantine and wanting to cancel everything. And the word cancel, it's lost all its meaning at this point. I mean, remember everyone going fucking crazy over old episodes of the Tyra show?
Oh, right. Did Tyra end up having to apologize for that?
She did. It was like, it was a nice apology. You know, yeah. She didn't really get into the particulars of anything. You know, she was just like, you know, sorry for some of those wild episodes, etc. The people complaining about this probably weren't even born yet. If we're digging into the recesses of pop culture to drag things, what the fuck are we even doing here? You know, it's like the history is there. Everyone knows about it. That's how we learn from it and don't do shit like that on reality TV anymore. You know, that's also why we don't manipulate people on talk shows anymore because, you know, Jenny Jones got a gay man murdered.
That's true. I remember that episode.
This just feels petty and dumb and useless. And the latest one is me waking up this morning to find Jimmy Fallon is over party because the internet has discovered that in 2000, in an SNL sketch, he impersonated Chris Rock in blackface.
I will say, I think it would surprise people generally to remember how recent lots of blackface comedy is. I mean, Billy Crystal hosted the Oscars 10 years ago or something and has a moment of blackface in it also. So, yeah. I mean, just be aware, we're shockingly green about that issue.
So long ago. First of all, this is 20 fucking years ago. Why does anyone care? Yes, we know that blackface is wrong now. We've known it for decades, well over a century. However, what does it do having a conversation about this dumb sketch from the year 2000 right now in 2020 when we're dealing with things like people actually calling the police on black people to be murdered? You know, like, woke up this morning to another clip of a black man being killed by police in the Midwest somewhere. And it is just so fucking unuseful for people to be making mountains out of nothing. What is this giving us? People were also mad recently about Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, which is a complete misunderstanding of the point that movie made when he was in blackface.
Right. It's a funny performance. Also, in general, if I see on Twitter, blank is over party, I generally interpret it as sarcasm or as
a weak attempt at a cancellation, like sort of putting the idea of a cancellation out in the universe and seeing if one occurs without the actual follow through that requires.
You know, it's just like this with Jimmy Fallon coming under fire. It was on SNL. There were a lot of producers, a lot of other actors who were around when this situation's happening, but were zeroing in on him just for, I don't know, whatever reason. And, you know, it's things like you can stop fucking with Sarah Silverman if you want to, because I think that her blackface apologies at the time were pretty weak, to be honest. I feel like I'm only mad at her because of her response to the blackface, and mm-hmm. more so than the actual blackface. But digging this stuff up in 2020, it's like there has to be more productive things to be doing.
I have to concur on that one.
Anyway.
What an episode.
Yeah.
Come back, Aida. Keep us on track, damn it.
thanks again to Issa Rae and Kristen Davis for joining us this week. And we'll see you next week. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Rustin is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.
Doors take us to summers away or winter adventures and afternoon getaways. Your dedicated Fidelity advisor can help you open those doors by working with you on a comprehensive plan to help you reach your wealth's full potential. Because doors were meant to be opened. Visit fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.